Please help me welcome our speaker. It is Cherie. She comes to us from York, from the Fourth Dimension Group. So this is Cherie.
Oh my. Hi, I'm Cherie, and I am an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is May 19th of 2005. And I have a sponsor, and I have the privilege of sponsoring other women in this fellowship. And I do belong to a home group called Fourth Dimension. We meet on Tuesday nights at 7:30 right in downtown York. So if you're in the area, come up and check us out. It's a very big, enthusiastic meeting, kind of like this one. And before I get started, I want to thank Dave for having me down here. You know, it's a real privilege to be able to do something in Alcoholics Anonymous, to be able to do something for Alcoholics Anonymous, because Alcoholics Anonymous gave me a life that is actually worth living. You know, it truly is. And I have a simple job up here tonight, is to tell you a little bit about what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. And truly what this story is a story of what alcohol did for me, and what alcohol and alcoholism eventually did to me. And how I came to AA and did the 12 steps and found a God of my own understanding. You know, and that's what this story is. And, and lived happily ever after. No, I'm just kidding. just to get started, the beginning, I was born in Reading, Pennsylvania to a fabulous family. My dad is an alcoholic. I can say that because he comes into these rooms. As a matter of fact, my dad has a little over 2 years of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous, which is something that we've shared, you know, and before that we had pretty much no relationship, you know. My mom was diagnosed with breast cancer. She went terminal when I was 15, and she passed away when I was 19. And I tell you that stuff not because I think that they make me an alcoholic or anything like that. I just got to tell you that they were really good excuses for me to drink the way that I like to drink for a really long time. Because it was always, you know, poor me, poor me, poor me. You know, all this stuff. I was a victim and everything like that. And in reality, I grew up, I was the baby of three kids. My brother and sister are both, 13 and 11 years older than me, and I was spoiled rotten. As a matter of fact, my aunt always tells this story. Apparently when I was born, my parents when they were in their late 40s, when I was born they used to put me in the center of the table, the kitchen table, and just stare. And apparently I felt like that was entirely appropriate and should probably continue for the rest of my life. So apparently I think that's where they thought I started to go wrong, but I don't know. But, growing up, I had a really good childhood. I was given everything I wanted, everything I needed. I was a spoiled, rotten brat. You know, I was talking with a friend the other day, and I don't know if I want to say I was an alcoholic from birth or not. I'll tell you, though, when I was growing up, I had this sweatshirt, and it had, 100 yellow ducks. And in the corner, it had this one blue duck. And across the top, it had this slogan, "Sometimes different is better." And that's how I felt about my life. You know what I mean? Like, that's how I felt. Like, I was always just, a little bit different than other people, you know? And a little bit, outside looking in. Not to say I didn't have a good one. Like, I had a lot of friends. You know, I went to school. I did the whole, you know, nine yards. When I was 9 years old, I decided I wanted to grow up to be a Jedi Knight. You know, I thought that the ability to zap people when they didn't do what I wanted to do would come in really handy. Also, a little bit before that, I had this habit of lying to my own diary. This is how I did, you know, at 7 years old, I read my sister's diary, because even then I was a great respecter of other people's privacy. And so I read my sister's diary, and my sister is normal. My sister is one of those people that has half a wine cooler and pours it out. It is a travesty to watch. it kills me on the inside. But she's normal, and she does not think like me. And because alcoholism is definitely not a disease of just what I drank, it's a disease of how I think, how I live, how I view life. You know what I mean? My attitudes, my actions, my perceptions, you know, my selfishness and self-centered fear. You know, that's what alcoholism is to me. And even back then, at 7 years old, I knew I didn't think like my sister. But I also instinctively knew you were really interested in what I was writing. So I lied to make sure that I sounded normal in case you opened it up and read my little 7-year-old life, you know? And that was me, seven. And You know, and I spent a lot of time when I was growing up daydreaming about, you know, who and what I was going to be. And I think a lot of kids do that, but I got to tell you, in my daydreams, I was always older, I was far away from home, and I was beautiful, I was confident, and I was excited about life, and I was amongst fabulous people doing amazing things. And I got to tell you, like, when I drank, I almost became that girl. You know, and that's what alcohol does for me. It does something different for me than it does for other people. You know, when I drank, it kind of loosened up something on the inside. And I don't remember my first drink. It was probably around the time I was 12. You know, and I got to tell you that alcohol was not frowned upon in our house. My dad was a functional alcoholic, never missed a day of work in his life. And at least not until towards the end when he needed to get sober. But it's not like, I don't have to be careful here because I don't want to give off the impression that I was allowed to get hammered every night at 12. You know, but it was one of those things where I think my dad maybe recognized some of himself in me, and he probably knew I was going to drink, and he wanted me to be careful. He would always tell me, you know, if you're drinking, call me, like, I'll come get you, like, don't drive, you know, don't drive in a drunk driving accident. You know, and I was obviously allowed to have the sips of wine coolers, or, you know, like, I don't know, on New Year's Eve, we would get into the vodka bottle and then fill it up with water again. He always knew. Like, the next day, he would be like, Sheree, like, it's all water. And sorry, Dad. But, you know, but I had a blast. I really did. You know, I had a really good time drinking for a long time. I grew up in an area kind of like this one outside of Reading in Morgantown. And, you know, it was, you know, parties in the woods and drinking down by the creek. And then I discovered the wonderful rave scene in Philadelphia, and that was, mid to late 90s, so I put on the big baggy pants, and I had my nookie and my candy necklaces and glitter all over my face, and I would, you know, throw around imaginary balls and have a good time, you know, and I just, you know, I had a blast for it, really. I love drinking and all of its buddies, man, I really do. I had so much fun doing it, unfortunately, it just started to turn on me. You know, it talks about in the big book that potential female alcoholics often turn into the real thing and are gone beyond recall within a short amount of time. And that long sentence is basically like I was screwed from the gate. You know, I really was. By the time I was 18, I was a hopeless, helpless alcoholic. You know, I really was. What happened to me is, and you know, even before that, it talks about in the big book that, the alcoholic has a reputation he knows in his heart he didn't deserve. And for early on, I was a big protector of my drinking. I made sure that I looked really good on the outside so that you could never say anything to me about how I drank. You know, so when I was going through high school, like, yeah, I drank, yeah, I went to parties, but I also had the grades. I had, you know, the clubs, I did activities, I had friends, and, you know, and if something got in the way of my drinking, I gave it away a little bit, but I always replaced it with something, you know, so that I could continue to look good on the outside. You know, I ended up going away to college, and that's where I had arrived. You know, I no mom and dad to come home to. I could stay out all night. I could drink all day long. You know, and I fell in with a group of people who were doing that, and we had a really good time. My first Halloween at college, I was an alcoholic. That was my costume. I swear to God, if I had known I was going to get sober, I never would have done it back then. But, we took white t-shirts. This would be my roommate and our best friend next door. And three of us got white t-shirts. On the front, we painted Alcoholics Anonymous didn't work for me. On the back, it said Rehab is for Quitters. We painted our faces yellow. Now, eventually, I would achieve that on my own. But back when I was 18, I had to paint my face yellow, dark circles. I had 40s in a bag. And I had a blast. Because when you're me and you're drinking like that, Halloween lasts a week. You know, I didn't change my clothes, I didn't do anything, I drank all night long and all day long, and I know I had a good time because I still have the shirt, and it's covered in, it's covered in like beer and wine and puke and like some kind of strange substances, I don't know if I want to know what they are, you know, I just had so much fun, I was doing all kinds of stuff like that, and then it started to go, and by the time I was 18, it was pretty much over. I became a morning drinker. I acquired another fabulous little habit. And just, you know, from then on it was downhill. You know, it wasn't a party anymore. It wasn't a good time. You know, those days were long gone. And before I would, you know, a couple times, if coming out of jail or being sober, and I would try to drink to recapture that, and I could never get it back. it was gone, you know. I have a progressive illness, and I just couldn't turn the clock back to the good times anymore. And so what ended up happening was is that I went through and I ended up dropping out of college to become an unlicensed pharmaceutical sales girl. I thought of it as a career change. I was living in Lancaster at the time. I had gone to school to Millersville and acquired, you know, some of these fabulous little habits. And so, you know, what I did was I dropped out of school and I would stand out in the corner, and I had, you know, had studied the people and that I was striving to look like, and decided to chameleon my way in there. And I had on, you know, the big pants and the waist beater and the big earrings, and I would stand on the corner and I'd be like, "What you need, Poppy? I got you." You know? And unfortunately, the DEA did not appreciate my career change, and neither did the Lancaster police, and they were actually the ones that gave me my first sobriety date. It was December 24th of 2002. The only reason I remember it is because I ruined another Christmas for my family. I was kind of getting used to that at that point, you know what I mean? I was kind of getting used to those looks when I would show up drunk or wouldn't show up at all. And, you know, at the time, they really didn't quite know what was going on. They just knew that I was a horrible, horrible mess. You know, they really didn't know what was up with me. And that all came to a crashing halt, you know, courtesy of the police. And and I ended up in my first rehab, you know, and this is where I met, that's where I met you guys for the first time. And I came and I sat in your meetings, and I didn't want what you have. You know, I did not want anything to do with anything that went on here, you know. And I knew I had to stay there because I had been in jail, and I didn't like jail, and rehab was better than jail because I could, you know, smoke cigarettes and eat decent food. So I was there, and I took up space in your meetings for a little while. And, you know, I know that I had people who were trying to carry a message to me. And I'm absolutely sure of that, as a matter of fact, because I was recently at my father's house. And what I do when I get sober is I write really depressing poetry about, like, you know, like when I'm in jail or I'm in rehab and I get a hold of some paper, I either write, like, I usually write about, like, the way light looks glinting off a glass, or the way, like, blood looks mixed in a needle, like really cheerful stuff, you know what I mean? And, like, how I've totally ruined my life again. And so I'm writing really bad poetry in this rehab diary I have that I recently found at my father's. And in between that stuff was people, I was writing about how people carried a message to me. They were telling me to go to meetings. They were telling me to get a sponsor. I had one guy there, I remember, I'll never forget it. He was like, "You need to get a female sponsor, Sheree." And I could not understand that. Like, I have a problem, what? you know, and God, and to do the steps and to find a God, you know, And I just couldn't see it, you know. I was too young, I was too smart. I was only 20, I'd never taken a legal drink, and I truly did not believe that I needed anything you guys had to offer here. You know, I had a sneaking suspicion you guys talked about staying sober entirely, which I did not think was possible for me. And I also heard that sponsors ordered you around, and I definitely didn't want that, because obviously I was doing good running my life because I'm in rehab, but I definitely didn't want somebody else doing it for me either. So I left rehab and probably drank again with my rehab romance, and, you know, just spent the next 3 years on this absolute tailspin of total misery. You know, I moved back from Millersville. I moved down outside of Reading with my family's house because I thought they were going to keep me sober. They did not. All they did was get a front row seat to my destruction, you know. I tried, during this 3 year period, I tried a lot of different things so that I could either control and enjoy my drinking or so I could get sober and be happy. Neither of these things could ever happen for me. I tried men and I tried money, and I tried working 80 hours a week, and I tried religion for like an hour, and I tried psychiatry, and I tried psychology, and all different kinds of stuff. And I'm not knocking any one of those. They just don't work for me, you know, and this is my experience. You know, I did get sober for a little while, for about probably 3 months, because I had a probation officer, because my life is being managed by the state. I had a probation officer who I just could not get sober for, and she finally came to me and was like, "If you can't give me a clean urine, I'm going to send you upstate." And those are kind of magical words to me, because that's clearly it is time to get sober then. And so I got sober, and it was horrible. For 3 months I was sober, and I was so sober, it hurt so bad. You know, what I ended up doing was I was serving and tending bar at this place, because I really like to do those kind of jobs, because it's like fast cash and late hours, and there's always people doing what I like to do, and you get the shift drink and, you know, stuff like that. So I'm doing that, and, you know, and I'm sober, and I'm working 12 hours a day from like 10 till 10. So all I know how to do is I work, and I come home, and I turn on the TV, and I pour a bowl of cereal, and I vegetate. And that's what I do, because life hurts for me right now. You know, that during that 3 months of just being sober with nothing else going on. And I would I would sit there and I would watch TV and I would eat cereal until the only thing playing was those Girls Gone Wild infomercials. You know, I mean, over and over and on the continuous loop at about 4 a.m. And that's what I would do every night, you know, and miserable, you know, the shame and the guilt was killing me. You know, at one time I had been a girl with hopes and dreams. You know, I had wanted to go places and do things in my life, and I never lost anything because the way I drank, man, I gave it all away. You know, I gave it, you know, my, you know, graduating from college, here you go, and moving to a big city, and here you go, and having a successful relationship, here you go, and I gave it all away so that I could have one more drink. You know, it was right around this time that I became well aware of the fact, too, that, you know, drunk or sober, I have no clue how to live life. You know, and I think I talked about that when I was really young. I felt that way, too. You know, I always kind of felt like I was like, you know, like God handed out the life manual and I was in the bathroom. You know what I mean? Like I was at home with serving in this restaurant. I would see my friends from high school come in, and they were all, you know, having successful relationships. They were finishing college. They were getting married. They were doing all of this stuff with their life. And I'm like, I'm eating cereal and I'm watching Girls Gone Wild. You know, and that's the extent of what I was doing in my life, really, truly. And I could not get it together. I didn't know how you got from, you know, where I was to happy, comfortable people who drink successfully and are sober and do well in life. Like, this just, it was like I missed that chunk, you know. And thank God I drank again. I so needed it. You know, I got off of that probation and the state wasn't managing my life anymore, and I promptly drank, and it was like, I am so glad. Like, where have you been? I miss you, you know? And I kind of made a decision at that point that I was going to chase it to the gates of death or insanity. Because drinking clearly didn't work for me, but sobriety didn't work for me either. And what ended up happening was that I tried to do okay for a while, for like a week. And then I just went, you know, on a tear to end all tear. And I ended up stealing my dad's MAC card and draining his account so I could complete a binge one night. And, you know, and the next day my brother came up to the restaurant I was working at. And I was okay with that. But this were not the first time those words had been said to me. As a matter of fact, I was one of those people who would go run the street for 4 days and come back and run and come back and do that whole nine yards. And this time it was a little bit different, because this time I wasn't going back. You know, and what ended up happening was that I had my friend drive me to the ghetto that night, and I left my keys to my house, and I left my cell phone at Turkey Hill, and I went out and lived on the streets. You know, and I used that term live loosely, because it was more like I survived. You know, and I did what girls do on the streets in order to survive, and I would walk, and I would sleep in the abandoned houses or on the park benches, and, you know, and it was horrible. You know, it really was. And I got to tell you, it was absolutely where I wanted to be, because when I am there, I can drink. You know, I know now, because I've done a fourth and a fifth step, and I'm not a victim, that had I gone to my family and I said, I need help again, they would have gladly put me back into a treatment facility. And I wasn't willing to do that, because me asking for help again, then I needed to get sober. And I wasn't having it. You know, so, and you know, I gotta tell you too, that some of the stuff that went on during that time, the places where I was, the people I was with, and what I was doing, you know, I would go to sleep in Reading, and I would wake up in Kensington Avenue underneath an L stop right at Somerset, you know, and I would wake up again, and I would be in an abandoned house in Trenton, New Jersey, and that's just kind of how I lived my life, you know, and I was just kind of like waiting to die. Yeah, that's really what it was. And I just found out you can't die if it's not your time. You know, you really can't. And God had a purpose for me yet. I truly believe that's why I get to stand before you today, is because God worked in my life and I wasn't even willing to have him yet, you know. And you know, some of those things that were being done to me and that I was doing, those are not things that, I mean, yeah, I'll drink over them. I mean, I'll drink over spilled milk. But, you know, I got to tell you that those were kind of conditions that I was willing to accept. You know what I mean? Like, conditions that I was willing to accept so that I could drink the way that I wanted to drink. I'll tell you what killed me, though, was I used to call. It didn't matter where I was. I would find my way to a payphone, and I would eventually call my sister. And I would call her, and I would pick up, and I would say, "Christine, I'm alive." And she would start to cry, and she would say, "Sheree, please let me come get you." And I would hang up the phone because I couldn't ask for help. I could not get sober, you know. And the sound of my sister's voice in doing that killed me. You know, absolutely. Like, I don't know the feelings that came from that. I mean, just welled up and choked me. And I don't know what to do with feelings like that but drink them away. You know, before I had left home, there was that look in my dad's eyes, in my brother's eyes, when I'm like sober, when they think I'm sober and they suddenly find a bottle that I left out by accident, you know, or when I'm stumbling through the door drunk, clearly drunk again, or when I don't come home and I don't call and they got to wonder if their little girl is in the morgue. You know what I mean? Like, that's the stuff. And the look that they would give me when I would finally show up. And I wouldn't care. I was about myself, you know? I mean, maybe on some level I did. It talks about in the book that we have moral and philosophical convictions galore. Like, I didn't want to hurt other people, but that want never stopped me from drinking, you know? And so what ended up happening is on May 18th of 05, God works in my life. And, I didn't even want him to. You know, I had made my way back to Reading, and I woke up that morning in a crack motel. I did what I needed to do throughout the day, they were still letting me come in. And I really, truly think it was because it was the only contact that anybody outside of that world had with me. It was the one place that my family could kind of know that I would, like, drop by. And I went there that night, not to work, but to steal money from the register. Because I suddenly think that the register money is, I'm entitled to that because I'm such a good employee. But so I went there that night to steal money from the register, and God showed up in the form of a state constable. My God looks like state constables a lot, but God showed up in the form of the state constable. He took me back to jail again, and they're quite familiar with me in jail. As a matter of fact, I was throwing up later that night, and the one CO came by and was like, "What are you doing back here again?" I had to tell her, you know, I messed up again, Miss Franklin, and she's like, "What are you going to do? You going to drink when you get out of here?" And I was like, "Probably. I probably am going to drink when I get out of here. That's what I always do." And, you know, your life might be a little unmanageable if you know the CO's name. You know what I mean? Every time you're back at the county, so. And my family found me while I was in jail, and from jail they put me into another facility. And it was actually in the facility, the rehabilitation facility, that I got the gift of desperation. You know, because at that point I was probably just convinced that I was just, actually, I can't lie, my plan in jail was to get drunk and go to rehab. Because I was, my family was so firmly convinced that I was just, it was the dry goods that were my real problem. They didn't understand that when I take a drink, all bets go off. So I remember being on the phone with my sister while I was in jail and just being like, "Chris, I'm just going to go to the bar and then I'll go to rehab because rehab's not going to fund me if I've been sober in jail all this time, blah, 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 blah." And, like, really, truly, it was just, you know, one big plan so that I could get hammered one more time. But they found me and they put me in the center, and it was actually in the center I got the gift of desperation, because what happened to me at, you know, whatever time I was sober, it was like 2 months or something that I had finally got there, that I had been in jail this time, and it was there, they took me to an outside meeting, and, you know, I'm sober for a little while, like sober long enough for like the bloom to go away. You know how the first week of sobriety you're all excited? And it's like, "Oh, I'm sober," and it's a good time. And then all of a sudden, like, that week goes by, and all of a sudden, every minute takes an hour. You know what I mean? And your skin is crawling, and you look in the mirror, and you hate yourself. You know, and that's exactly where I was. And every day that knot in my gut was there, and it took me to an outside meeting, and I decided to run. Yeah. That's as simple as it was. You know, I had this thing in my head that kept going, one more time, Sheree, just do it one more time. One more time and you're done forever. You know, this time you can't get caught. You're going to go back to the facility and all this in my head. And I was like, well, yeah, I can do it one more time. I'm going to this outside meeting. It's near an area I used to frequent. And I'll just go real quick while we're at the meeting. And I'm a horrible criminal. And I got caught. And again, God was working in my life without my permission. You know, it was from that rehab facility that they sent me up to York, Pennsylvania, into this recovery house. And again, it was all God, because he sent me to this house with these two sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, these women who are still sober today, and they're some of my best friends, are absolutely no bullshit. You know, they are, you can tell when somebody pays lip service to this program. That's all I'm going to say. You know, like, God bless them. And these girls did not pay lip service to this program. These girls talked about praying on their knees. They talked about calling a sponsor and helping out new girls, and that's exactly what they did. And I saw it. Like, for the first time in a long time, I was with people whose actions matched their words. I saw my roommate get on her knees to pray, you know, and I saw her... I saw them call and talk to their sponsors and go to meetings and reach their hand out. And they reached their hand out to me, you know. And the one of them, now I was new to York, but I knew that Turkey Hill was like 5 blocks from our house. But she tricked me. She told me we were going to go on a walk to Turkey Hill to get cigarettes. And it was like an hour later, and we still weren't there. So it was like 2 years later, I was like, you tricked me. She's like, it was the only way I could talk to you. But, but she took me on this walk to Turkey Hill, and she carried a message to me. And she carried a message of the 12 steps and of sponsorship and of a loving God, you know, and the higher power thing. I just use the calm God, so y'all know what I'm talking about. You know, I think if I start to tell you what my God is like, I'm going to live it in. You know what I mean? So I just leave that open, you know. You know, they carried this undeniable message to me, this message of a weight and depth, you know, and I was just beaten enough that I was willing to say, okay. I'm not saying I came to these rooms and was like all joyous, let's go do this fourth and fifth step thing, but I was willing enough to say it, okay. And they took me to a meeting and I met my sponsor. You know, and she asked me some of those, like, sponsorly questions, you know, like, what's your name? And no, she asked me if I was an alcoholic and if I was willing to go to any length. And I didn't know what that meant, either of those meant. But I do know a yes question when I hear it, you know. And I think some of you guys might know a yes question, too. It kind of sounds like when the judge is looking down and is like, are you sorry for what you've done? You say yes, whether you're sorry or not, you know. So, you know, I answered yes, and once she did this, she started taking me on this journey. You know, before I knew it, she had me going, you know, through the book, and we did the doctor's opinion, and we sat down and did 1, 2, and 3. I remember we did the third step prayer in a meeting. Like, we have up in New York this meeting called Fellowship, and it's in this big church gymnasium in the bottom of the church, and we were underneath the basketball. We were underneath the basketball hoops, and my sponsor's like, get on your knees, we're going to do third step prayer. I thought that was totally out of line. I mean, I'm praying in public, like it was freaking me out. But I was willing, you know, and it was right around this time that I started to see a God working in my life, undeniably. I mean, I was sober, so that in itself was a miracle. But it was this one experience that I always talk about that stood out to me. It's probably right around this time that I got really angry at my sponsor, shocker, you know, untreated newcomer, and I really mad at her. I went outside and I was sitting on this bench outside the recovery house, and I'm, you know, my head's going like a million miles a minute, like it is when we're new, and my head's like, oh, blah, 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 and, you know, and then I'm like looking at the bar and I'm looking down the street, and do I go down there, blah, 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 and back and forth, and I don't know, and should I stay sober, I'm flunking AA, oh my God, well, you know, and I'm just going back and forth like that crazy. And I remember the two people in AA talk about prayer. And I was praying every day. I was, you know, on my knees the way I was directed to, but I hadn't really felt it. And, you know, what I did was I decided to say a prayer. And this is how I prayed in early sobriety. It was, Dear God, if you're out there, because I don't think you are, could you please send me an obvious answer in the next 5 minutes that I should stay sober and stay in Alcoholics Anonymous, because otherwise I'm just going to get drunk. And sure enough, in the next 5 minutes, a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous pulled up to the bus stop and asked me if I needed a ride. You know, and I was blown away. I really was. I was like, that was my obvious answer. You know, and I had asked, and, you know, with the force of a sledgehammer, God had showed up for me. I remember I called my sponsor later that night, and I was like, I talked to God. She was like, what'd he say? I don't remember, but it probably was something along the lines of, yes, I will go to meeting chess or something like that, because I was, you know, being very unwilling about certain things. But, you know, and it just continued from there. You know, she directed me to do a fourth and a fifth step. I did that. We did my fifth step at a pool. Now, I was 4 or 5 months sober. You know, all my skin was absolutely destroyed because of living on the street. I was huge from jail food. And I'm sitting in a bathing suit and outside this huge public pool with, I think, everyone in York came that day. And I'm reading my fifth step. It was torture. But again, I was willing to do it. And I got to tell you, too, you know, for a minute after that fifth step, my head fell silent. You know, and I didn't care about how I looked in my bathing suit, and I didn't care about all these people. I was free from the guilt and the shame of the past for just a minute, you know, and I was hooked. That really, like, hooked me. I hadn't, the power of that moment, like, I hadn't achieved that feeling in a long time of just really feeling sort of okay with the universe, you know, and not thinking about how I'm 23 years old in a recovery house with a 10 o'clock curfew. You know what I mean? Like, I really, truly was okay. And I got to tell you, too, that's how I got sober, and that's how I got happy. And you'll see in a minute, like, my life is really filled up. But I got to tell you that I got happy living in that recovery house, walking to meetings with my girlfriends, with nothing. I mean, I came to AA with a trash bag, you know? And that's how I got sober and happy. You know, and from there, it just went on. You know, she directed me to go to do 6 and 7 under the big book. I didn't know what a character defect was. I didn't want to ask. Apparently, pride is a character defect. I did not know that at the time. you know, just all this stuff. I did not know the importance of 6 and 7. I think I went home the first time I did it and, you know, sat there for 40 minutes and thought about myself and said the prayer and, like, bounced down the recovery house stairs to go see my friends and on to eat, you know. Let's bring it on. Let the healing begin. And, you know, it was a little bit later on that those character defects came back to bite me in the ass. You know, they really did. Around a year and a half sober, you know, I was on the outside. My life was awesome. I was doing everything you guys told me to do in AA. And on the inside, I hit a stumbling block. You know, I really did. Like, it was, you know, the start of a new period of growth and sobriety. I had, you know, character defects flying galore. It turns out I wasn't so good at practicing principles in all my affairs, although you couldn't have told me that at the time. And I was just, you know, and I was miserable. And the real thing was that I wasn't opening my mouth to tell anybody about it. You know what I mean? Like, I threw on the A happy face and I'm fine. You know, I'm fine. Don't you see all my sponsees? And in reality, like, is that, like, you know, my sponsor always taught me that the flow of God and the flow of AA works in two ways, like a pond. Like, I've got to have a flow in and a flow out, you know, and it's in order to keep fresh like that. And, you know, what ended up happening was is that I was driving around York listening to Freebird and crying a lot. You know, like, oh, I'm never going to change. Oh, I hate this. And and that's what I was doing at that period of my sobriety. And, you know, what ended up happening is I didn't need another inventory with my grand sponsor. And my God got to grow a little bit, and I got to see who and what I was in sobriety. You know, and work out a program of action of growing into who I want to be. You know, and now that 6 and 7 step are so important to me. You know, I have a true desire to grow into the woman that I believe God wants me to be. You know, my sponsor promised me when I came into AA that I never had to be the girl who walked through that door again. You know, the girl who came in all beaten and broken. You know, And I haven't had a beer, and I'm not the girl that I want, the woman that I want to be yet, and I'm somewhere in the middle, and I keep growing. You know, and now I live with 6 and 7, you know, I say the third step prayer, I say the 7-step prayer every day, you know, and I ask God to remove this stuff, and I go out there with this mindset of, what would God have me do, what would God have me be? You know what I mean? And I don't always know. Those answers aren't always, you know, crystal clear. But I know He wants me to be kind. I know He wants me to be loving. I know He wants me to help out His other kids. And amazingly enough, by flying with those ideas, I actually do fairly well in my life, you know? And, you know, just on, I made my 8-step list and I set out to do amends. And, you know, the big amends for me, like the first one I was directed to, you know, it was one of those ones where, you know, it was easy. It was right there. And, it, you know, she patted me on the back and asked me to say sober, and I was okay with that. You know, and, these amends things are great. You know, I was directed then to go back and make amends to my mother's grave. And I got to tell you that when my mom passed away, I was 19 years old. I was deep within active alcoholism, and I was in the bar when my mom died. And that's what alcoholism does to a girl like me. You know, I had so many good intentions to be with her. I was with her for a little while, you know, earlier the day before and earlier that day. And they gave me a break and I went to drink. You know, and when I finally got the call, that's where I was. And I thought my mom knew that. And I thought she hated me for a really long time. You know, and my sponsor sent me back to make amends to her. And, you know, I drove up, and at this point I had gotten a car back, and I drove, and I sat at the cemetery, and I talked to her, and you know, I said what we said, and I started talking to her about all those hopes and dreams, and what had happened, and what I wanted for the future, and you know, I walked away from that event, and I was a changed person on the inside, you know, and I was reading this book recently, and it talks about, like, spirituality is the transformation within, you know, And that's where my heart changed. My God got a little bit bigger. You know, it's like I came to AA with this guy. It was like this idea of God, or this thing inside of me was this little tiny rock. And every time I took another action in AA, a little piece came off. You know, and this loving thing shone through. That's about as close as I can get to it. And, you know, and it's been amazing. Like, I walked away and my mom, I truly believe my mom didn't hate me anymore. You know, and that's what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me. I gotta tell you too, it's come sort of, I don't want to say full circle, but I have the privilege of being able to write part-time for a living. freelance writing is a little bit difficult, but I do, I write for a publication outside of where I live, up in New York, down in Lancaster, I write, and you know, one of the things that I was privileged enough to do this month was to be able to share my experience as being the daughter of someone who died from breast cancer, and being able to urge women to go and have their health issues addressed, and being able to tell the story of my mother's life and to give a tribute to her. You know what I mean? And I don't think I would have been able to do that had I not been, you know, made amends to her, had I not removed that certainty she hated to me. You know, and you know, to be able to do that is just amazing. It's so funny, the issue just came out, my dad called me, and he can't read it, and it's okay. He's still pretty, you know, he's still, it's been, oh God, 7 years since my mom passed, but he's still pretty, it gets him worked up, and, but he was telling me about the people that were reading it, and how excited they were about it, you know, and that's what AA does for me, you know, and you know, I went and I did a couple other different amends, and, you know, God always puts these things in my life when I need them, you know. It was just 2 years ago, some of the names on my amends list were my college roommates. Now, I ripped through these people's life. They saw me downward spiral like nobody else did. And I stole their peace of mind every night in that house, just like I stole my family's. I stole their peace of mind, and, you know, the one doesn't want anything to do with me, and I was in Lancaster that night. I had just finished finals, and I was going to do a 5-step with a girl I sponsored down there, and I was telling her how when I go to Lancaster, I look over my shoulder, because there's a lot of people who at one time might have cared if I was there or not, you know, and because they could run the other way. And so we're driving around, and we finally find a parking spot, and we go into this girl's building, and here come my college roommates. You know what I mean? And that's how God works in my life, and I got to make amends on the spot, you know, and they didn't want my phone number, and they don't really want to have me in their life, but I don't have to look over my shoulder anymore when I go to Lancaster, You know, and it's this freedom that the steps have given me, and through that I can better be of maximum service, you know. And you know, I went through the rest of the steps and went, you know, 10 and 11 and, you know, and the 11th step, you know, I was brought up with people that did a lot of different things in AA in terms of prayer and meditation. And I got to tell you that it's my experience that in the seeking, my God shows up. You know, and you know, step 12, you know, being able to carry this message. I have the privilege of sponsoring a lot of girls today and being a part of their life. And, you know, I have a couple girls that were going through the Big Book line by line, and it's so magical. It is, there is no other word to describe to be able to sit there with somebody and to, like, we're both talking about the same line in the Big Book and how our experiences matching up, and she felt this and I felt this and this is what happened. You know, and I've had about the privilege of being able to stand with women who get their children back, and, you know, to watch these girls walk into AA dead the way I was, and have the light comes on and their head goes up and they don't want to die anymore, you know. And I'm practicing principles in all my affairs. I was bad at it for a while, you know, and I do the best I can. You know, when my sister asked me to show up today, I show up. You know, when I show up at work. I suit up and I show up, and that's what my sponsor taught me. And through doing that, you know, I can't even tell you I'm not the person that's walked into AA. When I was driving to get my sponsor tonight, because she wrote down with me, and thank you for doing that. When I drove by these projects that I was quite familiar with back in the old days, and I looked at them, and I my stomach twisted, and I can't believe that I was once that girl in there. And I was, and that is absolutely a part of me. And I can easily be that girl again if I don't keep up with my spiritual maintenance, you know. But it's just, I mean, it's talk about living two lifetimes. The perception change that Alcoholics Anonymous has given me is unreal. You know, the change in the way I look at my life is amazing. So, you know, as a result of doing all of that stuff, I got to tell you what I'm like now. Well, I acquired the outside stuff that a lot of normal, you know, I guess normal, I've never been normal, so I don't know, but normal 27-year-olds have. I got the car and the cell phone and the apartment, because I never had all that stuff. You know, people talk about losing, they talk about losing all that stuff from the podium. I never even got to have it. You know what I mean? Like, I could never keep it together long enough to get it. So I got all of that stuff, and I recently became engaged. You know, so as a result of practicing principles with this man in Alcoholics Anonymous, and, you know, we practice the traditions in our relationship, and we invite God in, and we both strive to see what we can bring to it. You know, it was a couple of bumps, you know what I mean, here and there, and like anything is. And those mistakes, like, I truly see them as places where God is showing me that I can grow. You know, and that's how I look at stuff. You know, we were together for a little while, boy meets girl on AA campus, and so we're getting married next year, which is absolutely baffling to me. I mean, I have some big stuff going on. We, out of nowhere, he decided he wanted to buy a house, so apparently we're buying a house, and the fact that I have credit good enough to buy a house is amazing. And, you know, I finished, so that's kind of cool. I ended up, the college that I was at, Millersville, I was asked to leave because of my little pharmaceutical deals. And I ended up being able to go back there. And I graduated last year. And I'm actually probably going to go to grad school there. I just took the exams for that. And, you know, and it's amazing, you know. And I have this job as a writer that I love, and I have a job as a server that I don't like that much, but I go, you know what I mean, because it pays the bills. And, you know, all of that outside stuff is amazing. It really is. Like, it is absolutely baffling to me that how I got from point A to point B. I don't even know, you know, that all this amazing outside, amazing, very distracting outside stuff is going on. But really, truly, you know, like, my family wants me in their life today, you know, and this is the stuff that I couldn't put a price tag on. You know, I have keys to all their houses. I wasn't allowed near my niece and nephew, when I got sober. You know, I stole from their piggy banks. That's the kind of drunk I am. You know what I mean? The selfish, self-centered drunk. And I'm only thinking about myself. I'm not thinking about the look in the little girl's eyes when she comes home and her piggy bank's gone, you know? And they can't get enough of me. You know what I mean? They really can't. It's a, you know, my fiance and I just took them to this York Fair that we have up there, and you know, the kids were like running around and having a blast, and he was all excited, and he was like, maybe we should rethink this kid thing. And I was like, how about you just put that to the side, buddy? But you know, I have so much fun with them, I really do. And the fact that I'm allowed to be with them, and that they want to be with me, you know, it's not about like what I do for them financially or anything like that. My brother-in-law was just telling me that the other day. He's like, the kids just want to be with you, Sherry. You know, and my father calls me and my brother calls me. And these men call me to tell me they're proud of me, not to call me and be like, what do you need bailed out of now, you know? Those girls that got me sober, we've grown up together in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, we really have. And you know, we've held each other's hands while we left. We've cried together. I've never known true. I mean, I have one true friend from when I was younger. But the friends that I have, those girls that I have built here, the friendships and relationships I've built here in AA, are like second to none. It's like we were sisters, you know. And I mean, it's just, oh my goodness. My world has gotten so big. That's the only way. It was another thing that I was thinking about when I was driving here and I actually saw those projects. You know, a long time ago, I was convinced that I would be happy if I were somewhere else doing something else. You know, and in reality, like, my world was really small. And it was a bar stool. You know what I mean? Or it was an alleyway. And that's all I ever did. And that's all I was ever going to do. And all those big dreams I had about going off and accomplishing all of that stuff, I never would have done them. You know, and I was thinking about that when I was driving here. I could not get out of this small block radius. And while driving here, you know, some of those things that I wanted to do, I've gotten to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I've gotten to see some of those dreams come true. You know, the graduating from college and the being able to write for a living. And, you know, just to have all this stuff, and it's just awesome. You know, and but even more so, and I know I need to wrap it up in a minute, but really, like, truly, I have, for the most part today, probably about 75% of the time, a peaceful head and a joyful heart. I really do. I didn't wake up wanting to die this morning. You know, when I go home and go to bed, I'm going to go to sleep because I got some big deals going on. But really, truly, I know I live within the palm of God's hand. I really do. You know, I don't go through life wanting to kill people. I don't go through life wanting to kill myself. I try to have an amount of consideration for others, you know, and those aren't things that come naturally to me. Those are what you guys have taught me here, you know. And tomorrow night, I'm going to go to my home group, and I'm going to see God work. And that's how I always look at it and always have. Well, I am going to see the God that you guys gave me that I found here in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, work and have these people who are, some of them, living, breathing miracles right in front of me. You know, and I don't know anywhere on earth that you can find that kind of stuff. You know, really, truly go and just literally watch miracles. You know, so that's all I have. Thank you very much.